I have a message from another time. A Reproductions Unlimited and Magnetic Terrapin Studios present Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, The Legacy of Korra and The Order of the Rose, Suite for Avatar and Trinity, The Dicho Suite, Fourth Movement, Familiar Spirits, by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Hi, that's me. With Ann Cross and Philip Jeremy Moyer.
Sinti Xian, Sinuway 21, 291 ASC. Sunday, March 21st, Standard Year 2410. Air Temple Island, Dicho. The sun parlor of the big house in the middle of the Air Temple complex was a scene of bustle bordering on chaos by mid-morning on Sunday. Corwin Ravenhair and Korra, with the aid of a team of air acolytes, were moving furniture around and generally reconfiguring the room. While they were about it, a team from Republic Telephone and Telegraph was on hand, along with a couple of technicians from Sato Computing Machines. That end of the room was a welter of discarded packing materials, uncoiled cables, and impenetrable telco jargon as the phone workers and SCM techs installed a couple of phones, a massive SCM Mark V design desk CAD console, and the heavy-duty dedicated data line necessary to link the last back to the mainframe computer at Future Industries headquarters. The commotion was such that no one in the room noticed that two people had appeared in the open double doorway leading back into the house for nearly a minute, until Corwin happened to look up from getting his end of the futon daybed positioned nearer the wall and saw them there. Grinning at the sight, he caught Cora's eye and directed her attention to the doorway as well. They finished arranging the daybed, easily the largest item of furniture in the room if one didn't count the design desk, and then went over to greet the new arrivals.
"I thought you said you were planning to relax here," said Corwin's mother Scold with a laugh as she hugged her only son.
"We are," Corwin said, "as soon as we've got the office set up." "It's not as bad as it looks," Korra agreed, giving Corwin's father, Griffin of the IPO, known to his driver's license as Ben Hutchins, a hug of her own. "You finally made it." "Don't you start," Griffin chided her mildly. "I'm sure you all had plenty to do the last few days without us underfoot anyway." "Well, okay, can't really argue with that," Korra conceded with a wry little grin. Turning to the two air acolytes who'd been helping with the furniture, she added, "You guys can take off. These two will take it from here if we need any more heavy lifting. Thanks for your help."
"Ha! Now the truth is revealed," said Skuld cheerfully.
"Everything under control over there?" Corwin called to the technicians. The senior man from SCM, a buzz-cut, intense young man in an immaculate white shirt, with sleeves that looked like they'd been rolled up with reference to a straight edge and then ironed that way, gave him a serious thumbs up and nodded firmly. Corwin returned a little salute, as if to say, "Very well, carry on," and then turned to his parents. "They're good. Let's go see if the ladies are up for some new visitors." "I know it looks crazy in there right now," Korra said as the four of them walked down the hall to the house's main living room. "But the RTT guys and Ryo's team will be finished by lunchtime." Corwin nodded. "Then Ryo's coming out this afternoon to turn up the link back to the mothership, and we're in business. By 2 o'clock, you'll never even know they were here. Apart from the giant computer." Skuld chuckled and ruffled his thick black hair. "My boy. I know at least three ladies who'd give you an argument about that," Korra quipped. "Hey, any finite resource can be multiplexed," said Skuld casually. Corwin cleared his throat theatrically.
"Standing right here," he remarked.
"That's half the fun," Skuld replied airily. "Have you not figured that out yet?" "Don't look at me," said Griffin when Corwin did exactly that. "I've known better than to try and slow these two down since the day you were born. Literally." "Thanks, Dad. Huge help as always,"
Corwin grumbled.
Live to serve, Griffin replied imperturbably.
Oh, Korup, remind me when things quiet down a little. I've got something to show you, said Skuld.
Cora looked intrigued.
Oh?
Skuld nodded. It's with the rest of the stuff. Don't let me forget.
Okay.
Cora knocked on the jamb of the open living room door and leaned her head around it.
Everybody decent in here? I've got a couple of stragglers to see herself in the Red Terror.
Come in, Cora,
came Auntie Tenja's cheerful voice. And the visitors found themselves ushered into the presence by a beaming avatar and quietly smiling Corwin.
Auntie, dressed in multi-layered red clothes similar to those of the island's regular inhabitants, was seated at one end of a large, comfortable-looking sofa, and Uchna, in cargo shorts and baseball shirt, was propped up sideways against the other arm. In between them, Corwin and Anthe's infant daughter Annabelle dozed peacefully on the middle cushion, with her dragon companion Garnet coiled protectively around her. Standing before the couch, Skuld stood looking down at the infant and hatchling for a moment or two, her face almost blank. Then she turned to Griffin as he stepped up beside her and said matter-of-factly,
I am so not ready for this.
It's not as if you haven't had any time to prepare, Griffin observed.
I know, but you know me. I got busy with other stuff. Besides, it's Corwin. I always assumed I'd have until he was at least 30.
Thank you, Mother, said Corwin dryly as Uchna, Anthe, and Cora all giggled.
Anyway, Griffin went on relentlessly, ready or not, we're here now.
Annabelle, said Anthe softly, rising and then collecting her daughter from the couch. Wake up, darling. It's time to say hello to some very special people.
What's up? Said Garnet blurrily, raising her head.
Oh, it's you guys.
What ho in that?
Speaking as though to a much older child, Anthe smilingly but seriously introduced Annabelle to her grandparents, first Skuld, then Griffin. They, in turn, greeted her quietly, while she regarded them with that abstract but curiously thoughtful expression Corwin had noticed on her in the very first moments.
Would you like to hold her? Anthe asked, offering the child to Skuld. She hesitated, as if she'd forgotten what to do with her hands in the 18 or so years since she'd held Corwin as a babe in arms. But between the two of them, she and Anthe managed the transition smoothly enough. Annabelle made a pleased little sound as she settled into her grandmother's embrace, and the awkward look on Skuld's face dissipated as she accustomed herself to the slight, soft weight. Turning to Griffin with an expression of wonderment, Skuld said as if surprised,
This is our granddaughter.
Griffin nodded.
Indisputably.
We have a granddaughter, you fool, Skuld insisted, as if he wasn't getting it.
Yes, we do, said Griffin patiently.
Our first.
Jointly and separately, as it were, Griffin agreed.
Skuld looked back at Annabelle's face, shaking her head in amazement.
Inconceivable, she muttered.
Well, obviously not, said Griffin, causing Cora to snort involuntarily, Corwin to cough awkwardly, Anthe to giggle, and Uchna to stifle a bark of laughter that probably would have startled the baby, then shoot him a reproachful smile.
What?
Skuld wondered distractedly. Then she parsed it and groaned.
Ugh.
To Annabelle, she said conversationally, I can't believe I procreated with a paranomasiac. Still, worked out okay for you, didn't it?
In my defense, you did make it almost unavoidable, said Griffin.
The pun or the procreation? Wondered Anthe innocently.
Both, Griffin replied promptly, drawing another round of similar reactions.
You're really on your game today, Cora remarked, offering him a casual high five.
I'm only as good as the material I'm given to work with, replied Griffin modestly.
That explains many things,
Cora mused with a judicious nod.
Skuld settled into her new frame of reference somewhat as the morning went on, and by afternoon she seemed comfortable with grandmotherhood, or at least to have arrived at a personal definition of what it meant that she could coexist with. Much of this seemed to hinge on relinquishing the baby as seldom as possible and soliciting tips from Jinora and Iki, who had had the experience numerous times and in multiple generations by this point. True to Corwin's word, the SCM and RTT teams were finished by shortly after lunch, at which point he and Cora rolled up their metaphorical, Cora was, as virtually always, not actually wearing any, sleeves and got to work straightening up the sun parlor behind them. By mid-afternoon, they'd completed the job, and the parlor stood reborn as the Mount Weitang project office. With the futon daybed tucked neatly into a corner and the little conversational grouping of couch and chairs set up alongside it, there was still a cozy and pleasant gathering space available, now with excellent views of the tidily configured workspace at the south end of the room. There, Cora's antique dark wood drafting table with its built-in weighted-arm lamps stood in the southeast corner, positioned so that the person sitting at it would be looking east toward Republic City. To its right, along the south wall, they'd positioned a long table that would be suitable for managing documents and unrolling drawings for later review. At right angles to the left was a second, shinier, more modern drawing board, the input console for the design desk computer. The computer itself stood behind the console, looking like a big, slightly squat credenza of polished dark wood, ringed by an inset strip of blinking lights and emblazoned with the sleek SCM logotype. Both drawing boards were faced by tall, rolling chrome stools, such that someone working at either one could easily move to the other at any time. Next to the design desk console was a regular, old-fashioned, formica-topped metal desk, sporting a blotter, another lamp, and a couple of multi-line telephones. Someone sitting there, in its matching chair, would be able to look up and see the futon, as well as the entrance to the room in the west wall, with ease. Alongside that, a miniature refrigerator for refreshments rounded out the accoutrement, completing the workspace.
There, said Cora with satisfaction, wiping sweat from her brow with the back of her forearm.
She climbed onto the stool facing her old drafting table and adjusted the height slightly. Then she twirled 540 degrees, ending up with her back to the table, and grinned at Corwin.
Not bad for 4 hours' work.
Corwin sat down in the desk chair and leaned it back at the requisite perilous-looking angle, surveyed the workspace, and nodded.
Nope. Not bad at all.
He picked up one of the phones, listened to the dial tone, and asked, "What do you want to bet that if I call Zach, he'll find a way to get a pizza out here?"
"No bet," said Cora.
From the doorway, Utrina laughed.
"I think you'll have plenty of chances to test that," she said.
"You didn't save any work for me," Ryo Sato observed, entering the room behind her. Then, to dispel any impression that he was complaining about that, he smiled and added,
"Excellent."
He held up a big manila envelope, of the kind often used for office correspondence, and added cheerfully,
"I haven't been idle anyway."
Corwin regarded him thoughtfully for a second, then said,
"Ryo, why are you wearing a hard hat?"
"I'm the general contractor on this job," said Ryo importantly, then knocked on the headgear he wore and added, "The white hard hat's traditional."
Frowning thoughtfully, Corwin turned to Cora and asked casually,
"Have we picked a contractor for this job yet? I don't remember even issuing an RFQ.
Ryo snatched the hard hat from his head and hid it behind him. "Oh, please don't say that where Min Min can hear you," he begged. "She'll insist on submitting a bid as a matter of form, and guess who'll have to write it?" Cora laughed.
"She'd do it, too," she agreed.
"How'd you get out here today?"
Uchina asked. I didn't hear you coming, so I'm guessing it wasn't by autogyro.
No, no, said Ryo cheerfully. My darling sister's the only one who dares to fly that contraption, and she had to go to the office today to make up for blowing off work the other day. Well, she didn't really, but she thinks she does.
He made a twirling gesture by the side of his head with a forefinger. She's a little bit crazy.
A little bit? Corwin wondered. But Ryo ignored him and went on. So I came out by boat. Little bit of a hike up here from the dock, but I don't mind. Gets the blood flowing.
He handed the envelope to Corwin.
Anyway, the first piece of clutter for your desk, son. Couple of prospective routes for your access road here. Cost estimates, all that jazz. I've got a crew of EBs ready to start tomorrow, if anything in there takes your fancy.
Uchina quipped with a grin. You're jumping right into this supposedly recreational project.
It's in my genes, my good Prince Tenjo, said Ryo with a courtly bow. Even when we Satos are fooling around, we don't fool around.
It was ever so, Korra confirmed with a slightly sentimental little smile. Then, rising, she said, That reminds me, I'd better go see what Skuld wanted to show me. You guys get started on that. I'll catch up to you in a bit.
As she left, Corwin and Ryo were beginning to spread the contents of the envelope out on the long table, heads bowed over contour maps with sketched lines on them, and Uchina was going across to join them, interested in spite of her put-on skepticism about how seriously they were all taking the project. Korra found Skuld and Griffin in the front room with Anthy, Annabelle, and Garnet, taking stock of the trunks and suitcases the two had brought across for Corwin and the Tenjos.
"You had something you wanted to show me?" she asked.
"Right. Here, check this out."
Skuld picked up one of the cases, a metal-sided attaché case type affair, that was a bit fancier and more serious-looking than the rest of the stuff, placed it on the sideboard, and opened it. Nestled inside, in a bed of contoured foam, was a technical-looking gadget whose function Korra could not divine by looking at it. To her it resembled nothing so much as an old-fashioned glass doorknob set into a cunningly machined metal housing, with an arrangement underneath to make it glow prettily.
"What is it?" Korra wondered.
"It's a metacosmic relay," Skuld replied. "The mate to it is at IPO headquarters in New Avalon, although, really, it could be anywhere. With this installed someplace on this side," she said, patting the metal housing, "your lens will work across the veil. Finally, you'll have someone to talk to besides the ancient masters," she said with a grin.
Korra pulled back her bracer to regard the silvery white face of her lens for a second, then released it and gave Skuld a sardonic look.
"And where was this 5 years ago? 10?
She wondered with a hint of mostly put-on asperity.
Skuld had the good grace to go a little red as she replied, "I didn't realize it was a priority."
Korra sighed theatrically.
"Ah, well, I guess it shouldn't surprise me. Goddess of the future, not going to have that much of a sense of urgency."
Skuld folded her arms and pouted. "You're mean," she said. "See if I bring you toys anymore."
Korra laughed and half hugged her, giving her a little shake.
"It's great, Skuld. Still a little late, I contend," she added with an upraised finger. "But great."
"Jinora'll probably want to put it in the council chamber," she mused, "but I'm going to hide it in my place in Senna, where the Lotus Council can't screw with it if they get stupid again."
"Oh, speaking of stupidity and councils, I have something less fun for Corwin," said Griffin. "Wally and Eve are scheduled to go before the Turing Board next month, and they named him as one of their advocates."
Anthy smiled.
"Well, for them, I'm sure he'll be happy to go, despite how much he loves the Turing Board," she added dryly.
"Eve was a little worried that he wouldn't want to do it," Skuld remarked, "particularly since they had to miss the second take on the wedding for the preliminaries."
"Well, that's just silly," said Anthy.
"I know, but she's nervous. Having your sapience judged by a panel of surly experts will do that to a person.
Skuld pointed out with a wry eye roll. Not at Anthy, but born of her long-nurtured disdain for the Turing Institute's system of synthetic sapience classification. Anthy, who had heard the stories of her friend and fellow duelist Dorothy Wainwright's wrangles with that organization before her own arrival in Midgard, nodded sympathetically.
"I don't doubt it," she said. "Tell them both they don't need to worry. He'll be delighted, and we'll make sure he doesn't get so wrapped up in the project that he forgets," she added impishly.
Griffin and Skuld stayed the night, then headed back to New Avalon in the morning, departing via the decorative pond outside the house after breakfast. Once they had gone, Anthy and Utna set to unpacking the things they'd brought over with them, making their temporary lodgings in Janora's father's old house a home, while Corwin and Cora went to file planning documents for the Weitang access road and supervised the start of its construction, respectively. After lunch, Anthy made certain that Annabelle was set for an hour or so, and then, at Utna's cheerful insistence that they'd be fine, went off by herself to a clear space near the airbender's currently vacant meditation pavilion. One of the several advantages of the bit of Svartelven sorcery called the Assassin's Last Surprise was that it meant Anthy could go back to training right away, and she wished to waste no time doing so, having developed something of a work ethic for it since joining Utna in Midgard some years before. Once alone, she summoned her draconic war staff, Rosenjäger, and commenced a series of drills, starting with basic limbering-up exercises and then moving into the more advanced forms. So absorbed was she in her work that she didn't notice she'd acquired an audience until she turned through one of the spinning counter-moves and saw the saffron-robed figure of Janora standing by a tree at the edge of the clearing, watching her with an enigmatic little smile.
"Oh," said Anthy, completing the maneuver and then whirling the staff to a rest position across her back. "Grandmaster, I didn't hear you approach."
"For all that we have a reputation for being a bit boisterous," said Janora, "we air nomads can be very quiet when we want to be. I apologize, I didn't mean to disturb you. It's the first time I've had an opportunity to see you in action. I understand now what Korra meant when she said you move like an airbender."
"She's very kind," said Anthy with a self-deprecating smile. "I know my skill is serviceable at best. I came to the duelist's way quite late in life, but I do enjoy it."
"I can tell," said Janora. "Walk with me for a moment?"
"Certainly," said Anthy, dismissing her staff back to the sorceress' pocket space it occupied when not needed.
"That's a useful trick," Janora observed as Anthy fell into step beside her and they walked toward the pavilion together.
"One of the many things I'm indebted to Corwin for," Anthy agreed.
"You said you became a duelist late in life," said Janora. "Because of Utna?"
"In a way. As a child, I was reasonably fit, a lucky draw from the genetic deck, but not athletically inclined. In my adolescence, I was never allowed to study a martial art or take up practice with a weapon."
Janora nodded. "Because of your brother?"
"Or the thing that had once been my brother, yes," Anthy corrected her mildly. "My whole purpose in Akio's world was to be, by definition, helpless chattel."
Janora's face was grave as she said with quiet ferocity,
"Monstrous."
Anthy glanced at her. Catching it, she smiled a little wryly.
"Does the intensity of my revulsion shock you? After all you've read of our history and our ways in recent days, you should know well that we air nomads hate the thought of being confined and stifled more than anything else."
"That's true," Anthy conceded. "But it does surprise me a little that you take it so personally."
"You're my friend, Anthy," said Janora simply. "That makes whatever was done to you personal to me."
She touched Anthy's arm gently. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to dredge up old, unhappy, far-off things with my prying.
Anthy shook her head.
No, it's all right. In the end, it's part of who I am. I can't escape that. I don't want to escape it, because ultimately it brought me to where I am today.
They mounted the short staircase to the meditation pavilion and stood by the railing, looking out at the broad sweep of the Mosei Sea, and Anthy gathered her thoughts for a moment before continuing.
Becoming a duelist after being freed from Akio's dominion was partly an act of rebellion against his memory, I suppose, and partly just a way of preparing for the demands of life as Utena's partner. I was determined not to be a burden or hindrance to her, who had risked and endured so much to set me free.
I find it hard to believe that you could ever be that, said Jinora.
I appreciate that, Anthy replied, touched.
They stood in silence for a short while, just looking out at the sea and thinking. Then Jinora said,
Nima has asked that she be allowed to offer to teach you our way of protecting yourself, as though you were an air acolyte. Technically, she didn't need to ask. She's a master airbender. Whom she teaches or doesn't teach is up to her. But she's very young and still a bit uncertain of her place in the world, she added with an indulgent smile. And it is unusual for someone not of our nation to be taught our arts. But Iki, Milo, Rohan, and I asked ourselves the guiding question that has shown us the way at every crossroads of tradition and modernity in the past, and the answer prompts us to agree. Whether you accept is your own business, but I wanted you to know that when she makes the offer, it's with our full knowledge and consent.
Anthy looked genuinely taken aback by this, something Jinora, who had come to appreciate the younger woman's aplomb, took mild pleasure in before telling her earnestly,
I didn't speak lightly when I said you're my friend, Anthy. I hope you understand that. I know your life is far too complex for you to make the commitments required of an air acolyte, but these are complex times, and if I've learned anything in my long life, it's that friends like you are too precious to choose blind adherence to convention over them. We made Annabelle a free woman of our commonwealth. We would do the same for you, whether acolyte or airbender or neither.
Anthy's green eyes went wide.
She said, then trailed off, not trusting herself to say anything more. Since you arrived here, you and your family have gladdened the heart of everyone in my family, Jinora pressed on. Your daughter is a spark of joy, and everyone here loves her and her dragon companion. Your husband has exceeded even my ambitious hopes and become one of Avatar Korra's best friends in little more than a week. And as for Corwin, well, Corwin is Corwin, she added, her wry smile returning. You've all become part of our lives here, and as you prepare to spend the next few months with us, you must stop thinking of yourselves as guests.
Looking Anthy in the eye, she went on,
Corwin and Korra may well be creating a beautiful haven for the five of you on Mount Weitang, and I look forward to seeing it a little more each day. But I hope you'll always feel that this island is a home for you as well.
Anthy continued to find herself uncharacteristically at a loss for a few moments more. Then, quietly, she said simply,
Thank you, Jinora.
You're welcome, Anthy, Jinora replied, and then turned it into a wry little joke by adding,
All of you.
Anthy chuckled, the gravity of the moment leavened somewhat. Then, with a curious look, she said,
What is the guiding question?
Hmm? Oh, said Jinora, backtracking in her mind until she found what Anthy was asking about. The question that my sister and brothers and I have used to shape the path of the Air Commonwealth these many decades? It's a simple one. With a broad smile, she said, What would Aang do?
Building the road was the work of only a few days. Once it was finished, the fulcrum of the Mount Weitang project shifted back to the Sun Parlor. There, work on the design of the house itself soon settled into a comfortable rhythm, with Corwin as architect and Cora in the role of project engineer. It became their custom to work separately during the day, Cora in the morning and Corwin in the afternoon, leaving Corwin's mornings for activities with his family, and Cora's afternoons for all the manifold duties to which she had to attend as Avatar. In the evenings, after supper, they would take up their stations in the project office and look over each other's output from earlier in the day, then tackle whatever collaborative necessities were nearest the top of the stack until bedtime. Or until, as sometimes happened, they dozed off at the drafting tables, there to remain until discovered and packed off to bed by a third party. Somewhat to Utina's surprise, Corwin and Cora mostly succeeded in their stated goal of not becoming obsessive about the task. They worked steadily at it, but only on rare occasions did they become completely uninterruptible. It was far from unknown for either or both to take an evening off altogether, in fact, if some other activity came to hand, and even when they were working, the Sun Parlor's doors generally remained open, inviting other members of the household and the Air Temple community at large to stop by and participate in, or observe, or just be in the same room as, the process. Anthy, Utna, Nima, and Iki took to playing hands of a curious card game similar to bridge over in the futon corner while the two worked. Occasionally, of course, some task arose requiring enough concentration that they would completely zone out, ignoring everyone else who might happen to be present. And at those times, their visitors would generally smile indulgently at them and leave them to their work. At other times, when the pace of work would slacken for whatever reason, they'd find themselves alone and just wander off down side tracks of their own, having long, involved conversations about anything and everything, and sometimes nothing in particular, taking a certain luxurious pleasure just in being friends of that kind. Thursday, March 25th. On one such evening toward the end of March, after everyone else had gone to bed, the conversation happened to turn toward Corwin's fellow Valkyrie, and from there to the topic of Valhalla generally. "Oh, that reminds me," said Corwin. "You're actually cleared to see this now." He rezzed up his Omni-tool and started riffling through holographic thumbnail images, asking as he did so, "Remember when I was 10 and you took me to meet Aang?" Cora nodded. "Uh-huh." "I asked him why he was a kid, and he basically said because he felt like it." She nodded again, confirming that she was still with him, and he went on, "Valhalla sort of works that way, too." "Yeah, I remember Toph mentioned that at the wedding," said Cora. Corwin found the image he was after and locked it in, then looked up and grinned. "Well," he said, "occasionally this can cause confusion." So saying, he made a quick gesture and expanded the photo he'd selected to a full-size display. It resolved in the air above his right palm, hovering there like a physical object, and he turned it around so that it was facing Cora. It took her a few seconds' consideration to realize what was depicted there, because she was coming at it without much context. The picture showed a group of people in a room she didn't recognize, all dark timbers and white plastered walls, not a style one tended to see in Dicho. It was evidently a candid snapshot, not a posed portrait. There were two figures more or less centered, and another pair off to one side, some distance in the background, having evidently just entered through a door that stood open behind them. With the setting processed, Cora recognized the central figure in the foreground immediately. To her surprise, it was Aang, as he appeared in historical artworks and as she'd seen him that time in the spirit world, a boy of about 12, in a young air nomad's typical traveling clothes,
He was wide-eyed and red-faced with a combination of astonishment and embarrassment. The second person she recognized was Toph Beifong, looking 16-ish, as she had at Corwin's wedding revels, but dressed in the gold and green of the Earth Kingdom instead of the blue and black Pillar's Page uniform Cora had seen her in on that occasion. She was pointing, not quite at Aang, though that had clearly been her intent, and had been caught in the middle of what must have been a titanic peal of laughter, her head thrown back, mouth fully open, eyes closed, all her teeth showing. Close behind her stood a man Cora realized, with a sudden shock, was Fire Lord Zuko, more or less as he appeared in the many portraits of him as a young man which were to be found around Republic City. His scarred face wore an expression of startled amusement. With one hand he had reached past Toph's shoulder and taken hold of her wrist, evidently to correct her aim. That left the other figure in the foreground, and Cora puzzled over her for several seconds. She was a beautiful young woman, maybe 20 or 25, and from her mode of dress, her skin tone, and her distinctive hairstyle, she was unmistakably of the Southern Water Tribe. But beyond that, Cora was momentarily stumped. She considered the mysterious woman's expression, which was very complicated. She looked surprised, amused, and a little embarrassed all at once, but above all of that, her sky-blue eyes were full of what could only be a pure and radiant delight. And it was that, the eyes, that made it all suddenly click into place. This woman was no stranger to her. Far, far from it. Cora had seen those eyes many times before, both in person, set in a face much older than the one in the photo, and in other photographs. Photographs depicting a dear friend, but taken many years before Cora was born. That's Katara, she said. But when was this taken? Where was it taken? Valhalla, Corwin told her. Have you ever looked for Aang in the spirit world and not been able to find him? Well, he shrugged, smiling slightly. There's a back door. He indicated the picture. That was taken not long after you introduced us. Aang, sort of forgot to change clothes before he went over the next time. Grinning, he added, like I said, occasional confusion. Cora gazed at the photo for a long moment, a mix of positive and negative emotions flowing plainly across her face. Then, blinking hard, she said quietly, I need a drink. Corwin startled her at that moment by reaching into his Omnitool's hollow field with his free hand and plucking out the photo, which she had taken for a projected image. With a gentle smile, he handed it to her. It was some stiff, glossy material, like heavy cardstock, and went to the mini-fridge to get her a bottle of lychee juice. She drank it without taking her eyes from the picture, then asked Corwin, How does he do it? After a moment's consideration, Corwin replied, Well, it's kind of cosmologically weird, and I'm not the best guy to ask about the details, but basically, just as Decho is sort of a pocket in the Midgard material plane, what you call the spirit world is a fold in the astral. It's not technically in Asgard, the same way where we are now isn't the same place as Zipang, but there are places where you can get from one to the other if you know what you're doing. If you don't, you'll never know the difference. So, like getting around in the spirit world generally, Cora said, putting the picture down on the desk with one more lingering glance. Corwin nodded. Only more so. It's actually a lot easier the first time to get from Valhalla to the spirit world than it is the other way around. Some of the more astrally savvy Einherjar from Decho spend more time in the spirit world than Valhalla. It's more like home, I suppose. The first time Aang made the trip, he had to be guided over by one of them. Cora looked intrigued. Who? Not Katara, obviously. Corwin chuckled. No. Have you met General Iroh?
Zuko's uncle. I mean, not the one who was Fire Lord. I know you've met him.
Ha! Said Korra, looking delighted. Of course I know Uncle Iroh. He was with Ai-Ai and me when the universe ended. I didn't realize...
She trailed off, looking thoughtful, then blinked as something clicked together in her head.
Oh. Oh! That's what he meant about expansion franchise. And all this time I thought he was talking about the Jasmine Dragons in Zipang.
She shook her head with a wry smile.
Clever, clever man.
Seeing that Corwin was giving her a faintly puzzled look, Korra explained,
We have tea in his tea house in the spirit world every so often. It's got good memories for me. I didn't know he was going back and forth, though. I thought he was just...
She shrugged. A departed soul, like Aang and our predecessors. I guess I never really thought about it. I'm a little surprised that's allowed.
Oh, sure, said Corwin. All the regular afterlives are linked like that if you know the way. It's coming back to the material world without authorization that attracts Forseti's hellhounds.
That's a bad thing, I take it?
Very bad thing. Basically the worst thing. I'd rather not get into that right now.
Corwin said with an uncomfortable look. By then, Korra had moved past being curious about the procedural niceties of the afterlife for the moment anyway. Her own expression settling somewhere between hope and trepidation, she asked slowly,
Are you allowed to tell me more about who's there?
I wasn't until the other day, Corwin said. But now, if you feel you're ready, I'll tell you anything you want to know. He held up a cautioning hand. But trust me, these things are best taken on a little at a time.
Korra considered that, then nodded slowly. Okay, she said. We don't have to go into detail right now. Everything at its own pace, right?
She smiled, a touch ruefully, and added,
Man, look at us, will ya? All grown up and responsible.
Corwin chuckled.
Or at least very convincingly faking it.
With a laugh, Korra agreed.
Or that.
Then, sobering, she went on.
For right now, just tell me this much if you think it's fitting. If I visited, would I be disappointed?
Corwin regarded her thoughtfully for a second, then gave her a little smile and shook his head.
I don't think you would, no.
The young heir acolyte named Sita happened to be passing the house just then, on her way from evening exercises to bed. Noticing the sun parlor all lit up, she decided to stop in and say good evening. It was the neighborly thing to do, after all. She entered the sun parlor to find Avatar Korra and her friend from outside having some kind of moment. It wasn't particularly odd to see the Avatar embracing someone. She did that kind of thing all the time. She was a very huggy sort of person. She usually wasn't both smiling and weeping while she did it, though, and Sita found the combination both moving and oddly unnerving.
Grown-ups are so weird, she thought as she slipped quietly back out of the house and took herself off to bed.
One of the things Korra had to do in the afternoons was make good on her offer to teach Utna a thing or two about fighting empty-handed. Every day from 2 to 4, out in the grassy space by the Bagua Circle in good weather, or in one of the Air Temple's dojos in bad, they worked on foundational techniques. Korra's aim was not to teach Utna any one particular style, but rather to draw from all the various ways of fighting she knew, which was most of them, in Dicho at least, to develop a free-form improvisational technique that she thought would work for Utna's wide-open approach to living. The basic framework was that of the form underlying firebending.
which was a martial art very like one of the flavors of Kung Fu from Old Earth, with the maneuvers reliant on firebending's enhanced reach stripped out as superfluous. From there, Korra layered in different elements from all over her world. Mute versions of the other bending-based styles, non-bender techniques from Kyoshi Island and the Eastern Earth Kingdom, and less formal street-fighting techniques from here and there and everywhere, some of them learned by experiencing them from the wrong end in clashes with Republic City's triads. For 2 hours a day, the two women worked and sweated together, usually spending the first hour on instruction and the second sparring. The daily ritual, particularly the second phase, called up pleasant memories for Uchina of herself and Caitlin in their school days, keeping their swordsmanship skills at their peak and occasionally drawing appreciative little crowds. That happened more rarely here, as anyone who would be inclined to gather and watch usually had stuff of their own to be doing, and authority figures to come and chivvy them along toward doing it instead of gawking at the Avatar and her friend. Of course, there was one important difference. Back in the WPI and DSM days, her afternoon workouts with Kate had not involved the occasional presence of a gleeful infant and a slightly fretful dragon, one lashed to her back and the other anchored watchfully on her shoulder. That was a bit weird, but at the same time, oddly gratifying. When Annabelle wasn't with Uchina and Korra, she often found herself with Anthy and Nima instead, and so racked up a quite unusual amount of dojo time. Even though both pairs usually did their work outdoors, weather permitting, and not in actual dojos, for a newborn in her first few weeks of life. As Corwin had predicted, she seemed to enjoy the experience, and the company, enormously. Though the book said that an infant so young should not reasonably be expected to have much in the way of considered opinions, it seemed to all involved that Annabelle developed her first particular attachments to people other than her parents during these sessions. They could have sworn, documented unlikelihood or no, that she showed more than a baby's standard Zen acceptance of others when it came to Uchina and Anthy's training partners, something Nima, in particular, took a great but quiet pride in. As for Corwin, he filled his days with a combination of the tasks due from all new fathers, undertaken for the most part in a spirit of cheerful collaboration, and endeavoring, as time and energy permitted, to show Uchina and Anthy more of the world he was, himself, getting reacquainted with after so long away. By month's end, he would have been hard-pressed to name a time in his life when he had been happier with the way things were going. There was only one nagging imperfection, one little thing that seemed out of balance. And as the new month began, he decided that he'd given that thing enough time in which to sort itself out. Since it hadn't, he'd have to take a morning and see to it himself. Thursday, April 1st. "You know," said Corwin conversationally, "when you said you were going to go off into the wild and live like a dragon, I didn't think you meant it quite this literally." As he spoke, he unstrapped his Cirrus J5 jetpack's control modules from his hands and slipped them into his side pockets, then tugged off the heavy gauntlets he'd worn underneath them. These he stuffed under the front flap of his cavalry-style jacket, freeing his hands to unstrap and remove his flight helmet. That exposed his head to the fierce, gusting winds of the mountaintop on which he stood, but on the other hand, it meant he no longer had to hold his neck rigid to keep those winds from grabbing the rudder and twisting his head off. Then, turning to look back the way he'd just come, Corwin added, "You've got a nice view up here. I'll give you that." Nall lowered his head and grunted. Not many people would just jetpack up to a dragon's lair and start critiquing the place, he observed. Corwin shrugged. Not many people grew up with the dragon in question spending so much of his time perched on their heads, he replied. Okay, I guess you've kind of got me there, Nall conceded. With a sigh, he lay down, abandoning his half-hearted attempt to loom and be intimidating, then asked wearily, "Something I can do for you?"
"Man, what's eating you?"
Corwin inquired without preamble. He looked around for a moment, then stuck his helmet on a conveniently about-head-sized rock before ambling around to Nall's lee side. "At first we figured you were just fooling around, but you've been up here for almost 2 weeks now. We're all starting to worry a little." Nall made a sound that was half growl, half grumble. "It's personal," he said, but Corwin wasn't having any of that. "Nall," he said, "come on. This is me you're talking to. Something's happened. Something that's taken you to this weird and uncomfortable place, and I'm not talking about this mountain. I didn't come all the way up here for you to blow me off with 'it's personal.' Not after all we've been through." The dragon scowled at him, then sighed. "You really want to know?" he asked. "You might end up wishing you didn't." "Lay it on me," said Corwin at once. Nall weighed the matter a moment longer, then relented and said, "Okay, you asked for it," and told him. All of it. How he had been called away from Corwin and Utrina's pre-wedding party to deal with an unfolding crisis within his then-girlfriend Umi Ryuzaki's family on Hyrule. How the aftermath of that crisis had gone south in not one but two unexpected and painful ways. How he and Umi had somehow managed to break up in the wake of a mutual triumph, and how he had been forced by circumstance, custom, and the sheer implacable demands of self-preservation to kill his cousin, the dragon Naxnehaz, in single combat above the mountains of Hyrule. Corwin absorbed this intelligence in silence, his face going grave and contemplative for a few long moments once his draconic companion had finished talking. Then, slowly, he observed, "And you kept this from, well, from everyone, but particularly from me and Utrina. You and the other rune knights, too."
"It was your wedding, man," Nall protested. "It didn't seem appropriate. And after that, well," he sighed. "Look, there's a lot of stuff involved in being a dragon that I never had to deal with before Nax. Stuff you can't help with. In fact, not to put too fine a point on it, you're part of the problem."
Corwin arched an eyebrow. "I beg your pardon?"
"Yeah, I knew that was the wrong way to say that," Nall grumbled. "Except, it's true. I grew up barely ever seeing another dragon. I knew our language, knew about our history and culture and stuff, because of the dreaming. But once I came out of the shell, I saw my own kind maybe once or twice a year. I wasn't prepared for being a dragon to just up and get so real on me. And it's got me thinking really hard about what it means to be what I am. About who I am, in a way I never had to before."
Corwin gave him a sadly thoughtful look. "And I'm the cause of that," he said. "You didn't grow up a dragon because of me."
"I'm not blaming you," Nall insisted. "That's not what this is about. It's not even about regretting that I didn't, exactly. I mean, we've had a lot of good times. And without even realizing it most of the time, we were doing something really important. But now it's something I have to deal with, and this is how I'm dealing with it."
He gave a draconic shrug.
"Because I have to now, and I don't know how else to do it."
"Alone," said Corwin. "Well, not entirely," Nall replied, sounding faintly awkward now. "Lakpa's helping."
"Many people have noticed," said Corwin dryly.
If Nall could have blushed in his full dragon form, Corwin was reasonably sure he would have, as he ducked his head and drew a haphazard line on the ground with a foreclaw.
"Yeah, well, it's not like that," he said.
"Mostly. She really is helping a lot. You'd be surprised how much insight she has. It's calming." He shook his head. "I just can't say anything here that doesn't sound like a euphemism, can I?"
"Not really," Corwin agreed.
"You said people have noticed. Is she in trouble with the elders?"
"I don't think so," said Corwin. "I'm pretty sure Jinora knows where she goes when nobody can find her, but she's keeping her own counsel about it so far, if so. Maybe she thinks you're a worthwhile project for a young airbender," he added with a dry little smirk.
Nall snorted, amused in spite of himself.
"I'm not sure I'd put that past her," he said.
"Has she mentioned," Corwin asked a little too casually, "that she was a total asshole to Nima a little while ago?"
"Yes," said Nall heavily. "You probably won't believe this, but she's sorry about that."
"It's not my business to believe it or not," said Corwin a trifle stiffly. "She might consider mentioning that to Nima at some point, however."
"I'm working on it," said Nall. Okay, look, I guess we're both sort of works in progress right now, all right? But we're trying. Just give us time. Give us space. Please. Okay?"
Corwin regarded his lifelong friend for a few seconds, then sighed and got to his feet.
"We're still going to worry," he said.
"I appreciate that," Nall replied. "Really, and I'll keep you posted. There's going to be a stage of the process where we need to talk about some stuff, I think, but I'm not there yet."
Corwin nodded.
"Okay. Whatever you need, just let me know. You don't have to be alone all the time."
Picking up his helmet, he added wryly, "I guess this means you're probably not coming to the Ferret's home opener tomorrow."
"What time?" Nall wondered. "Doors open at 6:30, said Corwin.
He pulled on the helmet and fastened it, then put on his gauntlets and started arranging the control units.
"Main event's at 7:45. The usual."
Nall nodded.
"I'll think about it," he said.
"Hey, Corwin?"
"Yeah," Corwin replied.
"Thanks for checking in," said Nall.
Corwin gazed at him for a second or two more, his eyes hidden by the reflective visor of his helmet, then nodded.
"You're welcome, Nall," he said.
"Remember what I said."
"I will. See you."
"Bye," said Corwin, and then he engaged his J-5's main thrust and rocketed away from Nall's mountaintop retreat. The dragon watched him go, then lay back down and heaved a mighty sigh.